side two of the second reel and then goes on to side one of the third reel.
And basically, there were only a few things that got into major arguments. There were, on the old Namyashu 30, chapter 37, had had a provision that seemed to read that once a faculty member had been given tenure, they had a permanent appointment regardless of anything.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was one of the things that we felt was not only unnecessary, but didn't make any sense. And we opposed that in the new statute. We won on it. Some faculty members sued under that old provision where they had been WSU faculty members for tenure, and there was a layoff, and the court disagreed with them and said under no circumstances could permanent mean permanent in that type of fashion.
Yeah.
So that not only did we win because this was our position, but we won because it simply made more sense.
You know, I'm curious as to, I guess we've got a chance to take. Well, I would like to know whether the committee divided on who people who were pro UW Madison and people who were
a pro UW and anti UW faction. It didn't come out very strongly in many areas. It did in a few. There was the issue again of institutional resources came up, and we could of course refer back to the statute of the merger statute, and we did succeed in getting that essentially made a part of it. There were strong differences between the WSU system and the UW system as to what tenure meant and how you could get tenure. The WSU system had, in effect, given tenure to anybody who served 4 years and had not been let go, so that there was no, there didn't have to be a positive decision, an affirmative decision for tenure in the UW system. Merely being there 4 years without being told you wouldn't get tenure allowed you to have tenure. Now, the Madison and the whole UW system followed the same practice, had a very strong view that there had to be an affirmative decision by the department that a person would get tenure. As you know, it's not only the department that makes the decision. And this was another issue that came up. In our system, the department makes the initial determination, and while the department's recommendation for tenure can be vetoed, there has never been a situation in the UW where a person could get tenure without the affirmative decision of the department. And this has been a fairly critical point, and of course another way in which the independence and the faculty governance role within departments has been significant in the history of the university. Now, we don't give tenure we can give tenure anytime we want to, but tenure doesn't have to be given for 7 years, so that a person could be here 7 years and only in the seventh year be affirmed as a affirmative action taken that they would be given tenure, or even negative action. So that this is the decision in Madison, and so we felt that the 4 year tenure base in the WSU system was quite inadequate, did not did not do it adequately from the point of view of assuring a real probationary period for faculty, and did not make the department the determining group here.
Now, Gail, this is, you're getting into what is already there on the record, and I'm trying it's hard, I know.
All right.
It's, but when you think about the interview, people listening to this have already read you. I would like to know whether, well, Joan Nussbaum was on the committee.
Yes.
I've heard some comments about him. Did you get any sense of what sort of a person he was and how much influence
he had? Well, actually, I knew Joe from Minnesota. He and I had been working on a master's degree in Minnesota when I was working for a doctorate in Minnesota.
Uh-huh.
So that Joe and I knew each other and had known each other over a period of some, almost 20 years. We hadn't been close during many of those years, but we had known each other and were on perfectly friendly terms. Now, Joe was the governor's man on the committee. There wasn't anybody, nobody ever questioned that assumption. He was head of DOA, and he had been named by Lucy to head DOA, and he was named by Lucy to this committee to make sure that Lucy's general view of merger took place. Now that was Joe's role. And again, some of these issues were not of very great consequence to the governor. Some of these issues relative to tenure were not of great consequence to the governor. They were consequence to people on the committee, and in particular they were consequence to people, to faculty members, but they weren't of great consequence to them. No, I don't mean that they didn't, I mean they would have had, if we had tried to make tenure automatic after 1 or 2 years, that might have been of consequence to the governor, but nobody was trying to do that sort of thing, and Madison was trying to make it a longer period, and so there again, it was not of consequence there.
Was he interested in that sort of discussion, do you remember, Joan?
Oh yes, I think
did,
he was, oh sure, he had me? Some interest in that. I think Joe has tended to be a very fine administrator, an administrator who wanted to have to lead very precisely, and in that sense wanted flexibility in terms of personnel. Therefore, from Joe's point of view, the more you could have flexibility in getting your own team together, the better. And so there were some other areas in which Joe was interested. Also, I remember very much, and it must have been July 4th, 72, Dave Hansen and I worked out, and incidentally, Dave Hansen, who was not on the committee, but was the attorney in the chancellor's office, I worked with him very frequently on elements of this, partly because to try to be sure about the legal language and for a variety of other reasons. Mm-hmm. Of all the people outside the committee and outside the university committee that I consulted with, there was no question Dave Hansen was the person I consulted with as much as anybody. I did it for two reasons. First of all, Dave is one of those lawyers which don't always exist, would put into legal language whatever I wanted, and not something he might want, it was what I wanted. Now, he might have taken exception to something if, in fact, it had been directly contradictory to somebody's thing the chancellor wanted, because the chancellor, he was working for the chancellor. But I think with one possible exception, and again, this was it had to do with the role of students, and it had to do with the problems of what you could and could not get through. It was one possible exception, maybe two. There was never any difference between the chancellor and myself on the general track we were taking. Now, he might have operated differently, and he might have done a number of things. That doesn't mean we were identical, but the general philosophy and track that I was on, I knew was in agreement with the chancellor. There wasn't any particular reason it wouldn't be, because he was concerned for the Madison campus, and we were concerned for the Madison campus. So things that were of interest to Madison specifically, we would have been in general agreement on. Anyway, on that particular 4th of July, we were trying to hammer out the language as to the chancellor's role, the president of the university's role, the chancellor's role, the dean's role, the faculty role, the student role. And we would work in Ed's office, and we called Joe Nussbaum, who was working downtown, and we exchanged views on how to write particular things. Mm-hmm. So that language, however it's been subsequently interpreted or however it's been seen in the sun, that was language that was developed in that situation, and our proposals then became what in fact the ad hoc committee accepted.
Was Joe Nussbaum, I've gotten the impression he was unsympathetic to the university. Yeah, this is just for one person. It could be that he.
Well, whether people were. Yeah, who was sympathetic and what was. And, you know, what constitutes sympathy is a very difficult thing. I had another connection, which I haven't even mentioned up to this point, with the Lucy administration, which I used on occasion, and that was Dave Adamany.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Dave had gotten his PhD here while I was chairman, and for a variety of reasons I knew Dave quite well. Now Dave, if the idea for merger came from anybody, it came from Dave. And there was no question. Dave Adamany and Pat Lucy would have said they were sympathetic to Madison and Madison's problems. And in a sense, I think they were absolutely honest in believing that. Others of us might have thought that was a peculiar way to show it. But that they believed it, generally speaking, I think is true. And I think that in many respects, Joe fits into the same pattern. They had a view that the state needed a single system. And they had a view that basically this was not going to hurt Madison, might in fact help Madison, especially to the extent that there were problems with the legislature downtown as a result of the campus friction and campus disturbances of the late 60s. You're always dealing with different people's view of what was what. And so this is the way I would put it. Joe wasn't a big problem on the committee, from my point of view. Most of the things that I was anxious to get into that legislation got in. And there was very little that Madison wanted that we didn't get. In fact, I can't at the moment. Well, I know one thing. We had never counted. We had always counted as part of your tenure clock years when you were on leave. Mm-hmm. WSU did not count years on leave as part of the tenure clock. Well, they argued about it, and at some point we gave in on that, feeling that that was not as major as some other issues that we really wanted to win. And sometimes you can't, it just isn't sensible to argue everything down to the last minute. And there was an attempt also to write in something for a review of faculty that, I don't have the wording, but it could have been very difficult for faculty members to have had the kind of review. It depended entirely on how the language was written, just how this would have turned out. Well, anyway, I did vote for it initially for a whole series of reasons, but it worked out extremely well, because then I could ask for reconsideration. And in the meantime, before I did ask for reconsideration, I had talked to enough members of the committee that I knew I could get a majority vote. And this was one of the times when Jack Pelosek was just enormously helpful. I remember very much that I had talked to him about reconsideration, and then he came in one morning for the, when there was going to be a meeting, and he said, "Clara, we don't have the votes today." And I said, or "You don't have the votes today." I don't remember whether he said "we" or "you." And I said, "Well, do I have to bring it up today?" And he said, "No." I said, "Okay." And then it went on for several, we had quite a number of meetings. And I know that Dave Cronin was in the audience. And yeah. And Dave said he would have sworn that Jack counted the votes and then turned to me and said, "Clara, you've been wanting to ask for reconsideration of something here, and I haven't given you an opportunity yet. Do you want to do it now?" And I did. I made the reconsideration motion, and then somebody immediately said, "Well, you voted against that." Yeah. And Jack said, "Oh no, she didn't," and which I had voted for it, so I had a perfect right to make the reconsideration motion, and then it passed with a nice margin of safety. But this was, as I say, this is one of the ways in which I found Jack extremely valuable and basically sympathetic to Madison. I think Jack is a very bright man, and he doesn't take to fools kindly, and I think he felt that the quality in Madison was something he wanted to help maintain where it was feasible in this.
Who was the problem on the committee? What people, do you remember?
Well, it's hard to say who was the problem, because it certainly varied with issues. And I suppose more than anything else, the WSU representative and I were the ones who were most
focus of the. Were you of the?
We were the focus of quite a.
Marshall Wick, wasn't it?
Yes, Marshall Wick. Marshall and I probably were most often the ones that had differences, but that may be exaggerating it, because there were, as you went through the law, there were peculiarities here and there, and you might get a minority of people who wanted to change this or change that or add this or that to it, which didn't particularly make sense to people who were more knowledgeable in the university affairs. And those people might have a lot of chance to talk, but they usually had very little role in any decision. One would have to go back over all those minutes and who voted for what, I suppose, to get the, and those minutes I assume are in the archives or will be in the archives, they were in the president's office, to get the detail of this. But I think as a whole, most of the significant issues arose relative how much you put into the statute. And as a whole, I should add here, I represented the view that the less you put into the statute, the better. And that as far as faculty were concerned, Marshall Wick was much more apt to want to get things into the statute. If you recall, the Madison campus had never had tenure as a statutory matter. It had been a regent's rule. And we would have been content to have left it that way. Mm-hmm. The WSU people were not content to leave it there, and Marshall Wick representing them, of course, wanted details in the statute. Mm-hmm. And so these sorts of things came up. I believe the statute as we wrote it provided for the legislature that they had a veto power on any decision of the university to eliminate a center or institution. Now, that wasn't totally out of line with what the old statute had read. But there was no question the legislative members on the committee wanted to be sure in certain respects that the legislature was going to have its role here. Another issue that I recall, and I don't know that we ever really wrote anything in the statute, there was an argument, for example, about transfer of credits. And they wanted automatically that every credit taken anywhere could be transferred anywhere else without any question. Well, and I'm trying to think who was the man who particularly had that point of view. I believe he was a legislator.
It was Hollander, Heinzen, and Molinaro.
Heinzen had that point of view. And as usual, he had a whole series of horrible examples. Well, of course, the trouble with that provision is that it could make it necessary to transfer credits when a student was totally changing his program. There are a whole number of issues that arise in this connection. Well, we had to reduce anything of that kind. So those were issues that came up. And there was also an issue that came up relative to the role of the UW system via the vocational system. And there were people, or one or two people, who were looking at the vocational system and trying to make certain that the university didn't overlap with the vocational system. Now, there were others, including Mr. Molinaro, who strongly felt that the problem lay in the other direction, and that it was the vocational schools that had deserted their mission, and rather than the university encroaching on the mission of the vocational schools. So issues of that kind came up.
Why did Dave Cronin come to the meeting?
Well, this was simply, I suppose you could say, Dave Cronin and Ray Bowen came to most of the meetings just to make sure that that people were conscious that there were other people supportive of the position that I was taking. There were others that, for instance, I think Ed Music came most of the time, as Ed Music, who's head of TOF now and who was vice president under Marshall Wick. So that there were people like that who came. These were meetings held more or less in a fishbowl, so there was no reason anybody couldn't come.
But I mean, now, it must have been very time-consuming.
Oh, it was time-consuming. I voted as Marshall Wick voted, and this, of course, was what Jack Pelosek really established, even though we hadn't been officially appointed. We voted on the committee regularly, and he simply co-opted us. That's all there was to it.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, somebody later could have said, well, these people's votes don't count because they're not.
Yes, it could have been said, but it was not said. And whether Jack Pelosek was a very compelling chairman, and it would have taken a good deal of nerve to raise that issue, since we were members of the overall committee, and I suppose Jack felt confident he could have legitimized the whole thing if he'd wanted to by just getting Solberg to officially to appoint us. But as far as I know, we were never officially appointed to the committee. We simply came and voted and operated and got all the minutes and meeting and notices and everything else after the first couple of meetings or so.
You were lucky to have somebody like Pelosek as chairman.
Oh, yes.
Who was responsible for that, do you know?
Well, you see, Pelosek was on the UW Board of Regents, and this again was one of those things. I think he would have been the natural chairman of that committee, but there was some friction between him and the governor, and so the governor made Solberg chairman. But there wasn't any question that Jack was almost the natural for this. His whole behavior and operation made that evident as things went on. And I guess Solberg didn't want it, wasn't interested or something in taking as big a role, why he appointed Jack Pelosek as chairman. John Solberg appointed him as chairman of this so-called ad hoc committee.
I don't think Lucy could have manipulated it all and said, we've got to have Pelosek as
I don't think so. Because if Lucy had really felt that way about it, he could have named Pelosek as chairman originally. Right. You see, there was a constant balancing in that committee between UW and WSU and supposedly, certainly pro-merger, and to a limited degree, there were certainly anti-merger people in it.
Fish, Rank, were either of them on the...
Rank was on it.
He was.
Was Fish?
They were both on the...
On the ad hoc
committee.
Yes,
but
we're both on the big
committee.
Wilbur Rank was on the ad hoc committee,
what
I know.
What sort of a person? How did he be?
Well, Wilbur was a pro-Madison person on it, and he, of course, he was a good Republican and not particularly pro-Lucy. And he was one of the ones that I was able to convince on the on this one motion that we wanted to recommit and get it, reconsider and get a change in vote. And he was one of the ones who had originally voted for it, and whom I remember having lunch with and convincing him that it was a poor one, that while review of faculty, even after they have tenure, might be desirable, it was undesirable to put it into the statute and get all the possible misinterpretations and possible court cases and so forth. He was generally, as I say, sympathetic to Madison. I suspect if you looked over the record, you would find that he voted about the same as I did. I don't recall that in detail, and there probably were some instances when we didn't vote alike, but he voted pretty much with us on the things.
Did you enjoy this?
Oh, yes. It's fun to do it, that sort of thing. It was very time-consuming, and as I said before, the dean and the chancellor both made a point of talking with me about it and telling me, you know, they to help me give up other things so I had time to do it. Now, there were times when there wasn't much to do, but there were times when it took, you know, there were hours and hours when you went on and on with it. So it varied as to exactly the amount of time consumption that was here. As far as I was concerned, I think that this is one of the things Madison's always been good about, the administration's good about. They do reward you financially when you take on big burdens this way. And I felt they did.
Well, and this is the question I had asked you the other time, of your service, various services to the university. And is there something more we should say about the merger implementation committee? Do you think that is not in your chapter?
I don't, you know, of course, I haven't reread the chapter, so I don't recall exactly what's in it. I'm not sure that there's any major thing that's missing there that we haven't discussed. As I said earlier, this is one of the ways you learn something about institutions. I first learned about institutions, I suppose I'm sensitive to this because of my training as in administration, so that I was conscious of problems even before I became chairman of the department. And I don't mean problems that are horrors or things you can't solve, but that you're conscious of the things that need to be considered and looked at. And that as chairman, I knew this and dealt with it and got a feel for the college, got a feel for the department in ways that you never quite do except as chairman. There are things you learn even about your colleagues that you never learn except by being chairman. As a member of the university committee, of course, I had a great opportunity to learn a good deal about the institution as a whole. And that's certainly interesting and valuable and gives you an appreciation of issues that you wouldn't otherwise have. And both in the merger committee, and because I'd been on the North Central, and am on the North Central Higher Education Commission, not on the commission itself, but as a consultant advisor, and because I've reviewed other institutions, I became even more conscious than I was before of the very real role that departments have, and that most of the faculty governance that we talk so glibly about here at Madison is in the department, and that this is where one can be most influential and where one can have a very, very considerable role. And I think I've mentioned, I don't know that I mentioned on the tape here, that as chairman, I knew the then chairman of the Harvard Department of Government, and he was out here one time, in fact, not too long after we had hired Austin Ranney, who was, of course, a very major appointment, and we got this curious, I had this very fascinating discussion with Merle Finsod on the differences here, and he was very impressed, almost floored, by the fact that we had essentially made a major appointment, made a recommendation for a salary which was as high or higher than anybody in the department was getting, and that we could do that as an executive committee. Whereas, of course, at Harvard and in many of the private institutions, many of the public institutions, it is the dean that makes all these decisions. It's the dean that makes every decision as to salaries. And our role here in a department and as a faculty on salaries is fairly unprecedented around the country.
Mm-hmm.
That which
we have.
This is July 15th, and this is the third session with Clara Penniman.
So you wanted to add something to your discussion of the merger?
Yes, something came up recently in a luncheon conversation, and I was reminded of the fact, also it's been very much in the legislature. For years, as anybody who's familiar with the statute knows, so the state legislature, or state statutes passed by the legislature, had gave the individual legislators scholarships that they could use for any purpose they wanted to, for any person they wanted to. And historically, many of these scholarships were the source of support for athletes coming into the football team or the basketball team or whatever. And the tendency of most liberals and many people to sort of downgrade this whole idea. And this section actually came to the specific attention to the merger committee as we were looking at it. And so there was a sort of general view of the committee, well, we'll get rid of it. At which point, the Ed Hales, who I believe is the first black ever to have been on the Board of Regents, and he was a member of the merger committee. Mm-hmm. And after all this kind of general discussion and assumption, well, obviously this is not a good item to have in the statute, Ed Hales rather quietly said, well, you know, that's how I got to go to the university. And I couldn't help seeing that as the fact that one of the things among our society and our government is that no matter how wrong-headed we've been at times, we've always seemed to have left some kind of opening that somebody could push through. And in this case, however blacks might have been discriminated against in various ways, the fact was athletics and an athletic scholarship did provide openings for a minority.
It's symbolic, isn't it? And yeah. It must have been I suppose the whole committee reversed its position.
That's right, the committee reversed its position. It's more, I think it's more, I kind of react against that word symbolism or symbolic, because it almost is as if we're doing it for no other purpose. The idea here was surely not originally to take care of blacks, it was to take care of athletes. And then in the development of time, in fact, it took care of black athletes.
Mm-hmm. And that he himself became suddenly a symbol of all the people who managed to get to the university.
Oh, yes. There's no question. Mm. He did become a symbol of what was possible through this sort of an opening, and therefore we, as you suggested, we definitely reversed our position. We left the provision in, and I don't know if the legislature is going to end up taking it out this year or not taking it out, but I've been tempted at times to call somebody or tell somebody this story and to suggest maybe it has a value that we don't always see just on the surface. Mm.
Are there any other things you think of?
At the moment, I haven't thought of anything else in terms of merger committee, unless you've got a question that I had.
Well, not really, unless there's something in of how you came to understand or think about the other campuses as a consequence of your work on the committee. And I don't have anything in mind.
I suppose to some degree in working on the committee, you did become a little more conscious of the varied roles that the different institutions performed. I thought that even more when I wrote that article or chapter in the Bogan Taylor book. In a very real sense, and after I had completed that chapter, I came to the conclusion almost that merger was inevitable, that there had been so many attempts over the years to achieve something of that kind. And while one might in some ways regret that the merger didn't take place 15 years earlier, before the great increase in size, when we might have gotten better planning of the number and ways in which the institutions were established. Now, the basic institutions, of course, were already there, but many of the state universities, or state colleges as they were then called, really weren't much more than high schools, and their whole campuses showed that kind of thing in the middle 50s. Mm-hmm. And if we had had a merged system that then could have done a bit more planning as the great surge of students came in the 60s, we might have gotten a bit more less competition just to outstrip each other institution, to add willy-nilly, and to have planned a bit more, not only to take care of the surge of students, but to have anticipated the possibility that the numbers might well decline in some subsequent period, and that certain types of areas or fields required conditions that were only possible at one or two major institutions in the state. Now, that's all wishful thinking, because, of course, that's not what we did. It is true that there was in around the middle 50s that, of course, Milwaukee was added to the university system, and that surely was a good move, and it was good that it occurred early, because that gave a symbol, if you will, after I had objected to it earlier, to the older system, and made certain that one of those institutions, even though it was now part of the UW, had a very significant role. And it does seem to me that in the largest city of the state, that was very important to do.
Mm.
But if we had included all of them earlier, there might have been better planning. It's all a might have been.
You mean because they expanded as state colleges?
They expanded as state colleges and eventually state universities in the 60s. And there was real competition between the two systems, as well as among institutions within the two systems. And therefore, if you had gotten it at an early point, where every one of those institutions would have gained something. It was almost inevitable they were going to gain something in the 60s. But they might not have gained some of them would not have gained as much, mm-hmm. and therefore would not now be in the difficult position of how do you pull back and reduce when you've got a large plant and you've got the expectation that they're in the community as well as for individuals. This is obviously true in terms of the center system. Even if you ignore or assume the other institutions that had existed for so many decades had continued, you surely wouldn't have gotten some of the centers that we got. And there was, during that period, there was a kind of competition between the systems, so that if UW put in a center somewhere, then the WSU people put in a center somewhere. And mm-hmm. you got this throughout the state. And if you look at your center systems and when they were established, you can easily see the tug and pull there.
I guess that's one of the reasons Harrington felt that he had to get the Green Bay and Parkside campuses in the UW system, that he had to, in order to balance it with the center.
Well, I think that was to some extent true. That, and it's also true, of course, that Green Bay and Parkside represented urban areas of the state that didn't otherwise have anything very important in an educational institution. One of the regrets, perhaps, that one could easily make is that the WSU people, for reasons that in part I think lay with the kind of leadership that was in the institution, didn't develop Oshkosh in the Fox River Valley as a really significant institution. If Oshkosh had developed as a significant institution, that much early, that would have taken care of another major urban area with an important institution. As it is, or as it was, it remained very much a rather backwater college.
Weren't you in on the West Side campus plan?
Not really. Because I was on the university, or as chairman of the university committee, I had a small role in planning. Well, then I really wasn't.
And this was in the 60s.
I was on the parking committee in the 50s.
No, this was I really thought you had.
If I was, I must admit, I managed to erase it from my memory.
Well, that was a possibility of having extra students, freshmen and sophomores, be on a campus, a second campus.
Yes, I did have some. I forgot. That's, you remind me. Yes, I did have some minor role in that. There was discussion of the possibility of putting a center or a freshman sophomore campus out on in one of the Charmony farms or one of the other farms,
yes, right,
of the university that still existed in the Madison area.
Well, then let's go back to how you got when you started in 1953, and what moved you towards administration first as department chairman.
You don't really, there's no career line to department chairman here in the university. I could honestly say that I never expected to be department chairman, never even thought about being department chairman. And I think two things happened. I think that I did serve as chairman of the fellowship committee, which at that time was one of the major, probably the major committee in the department. And I think I did that in a fashion that was very satisfactory to many of my colleagues. And secondly, one gets to be chairman in any department in part because there are objections to other possible candidates. And I think one has to say that in my case, as in many other people's cases, you partly get to be chairman because you are viewed with the most equanimity or the least antagonism of anybody in the anybody else that's likely to be chairman. And I recall very vividly that Leon Epstein was chairman, and Leon asked me to have lunch with him one day, and to my surprise he said to me that my colleagues would like me to take on the chairmanship. And I said, well, Leon, I must say this is something that I never expected to be asked to do. And he said, well, maybe that's why you're being asked. You know? So I think that's about as good an explanation of how I became chairman as it's possible for me to give. I think chairmanships are very much an internal politics, developmental matter in any given department. Mm-hmm. And I did have the chairmanship in a period of substantial growth, and as a whole, I think my chairmanship went relatively smoothly.
How had the department been having the three-year?
The three-year term actually started with Leon Epstein, who just preceded me. Prior to that, the department was a good deal smaller, and chairmen tended to have fairly indefinite terms. Some of them ran, and they often seemed to run 4, 5, 6, 7 years, somewhat depending on how the person who was chairman felt about it.
Mm-hmm.
That as long as there was no big deal about it and the individual was willing to continue the responsibility, that seemed to be what happened. And in my immediate predecessors, as I say, first was Leon Epstein, then it was Bill Young before that, and Jim McCamey before that, and Llewellyn Fonkuchen before that. And I believe Llewellyn and Jim had it for 4 years each, and Bill had it, I believe, 7 years. Bill was the longer period. And Leon, I think, reflecting in part the considerable change in the makeup of the department and the growth of the department generally, and the probability that there were going to be more available candidates for the chairmanship, I think all of these things probably entered into his consideration. In any event, he declared that he would keep it for only 3 years and more or less established that as the president. It certainly has been the way in which we have operated since then. Every chairman, beginning with Leon, has assumed that he or she has responsibility for 3 years and is going to be able to give it up at that time.
Mm-hmm.
The chairman, as you know, the chairman is elected with the ballots going to the dean.
Mm-hmm.
And the dean technically then has the appointing power, but is normally guided by the results of the election within the department.
You didn't have any Walter Mortons or people of that sort in your department, is that right? Or did you?
No, that's pretty much true. Certainly in the years through the 60s, certainly in the years through my chairmanship, we had a very smooth operating department with very few occasions on which there was any great division. And I think it was a year or two after I was chairman that for the first time in my experience here, we actually had a formal vote on a tenure case and accepted the results of the formal vote, whereas before that, either in appointments or in promotions, we always had a chance, everybody spoke their piece, and there was a kind of consensus developed that as I always said, we didn't allow somebody to to simply veto what most people in the department wanted. On the other hand, there was no tendency to ride roughshod over a minority,
mm-hmm.
so that we usually came to an agreement on what I could only say is a consensus, but which didn't allow for an absolute veto by somebody in there.
So what happened that you decided?
Well, we had a case of whether somebody should be promoted to tenure, and there was considerable division within the department, and the people who wanted him promoted finally insisted on a vote. And I remember I protested on the grounds that it was not our norm,
mm-hmm.
but there was an insistence on the vote. And the people who protested and wanted the vote lost on the vote by a very small number. It was a very evenly, in other words, it was a very evenly mm-hmm. divided department. But in the past, whenever it was an even, more or less evenly divided department, then we would not have given tenure. Well, as it turned out, of course, we didn't give tenure because the more or less even division was just enough against giving tenure that's the way it worked out.
Mm-hmm.
But in the past, we'd have agreed to that without the formal vote. Subsequently, of course, we have had formal votes, and now today, of course, it's a requirement.
Mm-hmm.
It's a university requirement.
Is it? I see.
Yes, this is all because of all the possibility of legal action, whether an individual is properly treated, who voted how,
yeah.
all the rest
yeah.
of it, so that for almost 10 years now, this is, I've forgotten the exact year that provision went in, but it certainly was at some time in the early 70s, this became an absolute
mm-hmm.
requirement. So, of course, our earlier, more informal methods of decision no longer apply.
During the 60s, the political science department was split on the Vietnam War issue.
Well, yes, of course. I never thought the Vietnam War issue was something that ought to have been a part of the department consideration, and I think that was one of the problems in the university, that too many people decided that their politics ought to be a part of their university decision making. It didn't affect us particularly within the department. I don't recall any decisions made as a department that one could relate to the Vietnam War.
Well, but in the sense that there was a group who tended to be against the war, or a generation gap, I guess I would say, or didn't it work out?
I don't think it was a generation gap, no. I think that was one of the errors that was often made in discussion, because there were certainly younger people who were on both sides, as well as older people who were on both sides. I don't think it was a clear generation gap. I couldn't
mm-hmm.
possibly
okay,
reconstruct
that's
whether
yeah.
it was majority or minority, but that you had people in all age groups on both sides, it seems to me it was true.
But that somehow, I think in the history department this is certainly true, that somehow there was a division in the department, even though it may not have affected decisions that split departments in a way that they hadn't been.
I don't think that was true in this department. It's always hard to say how do you mean split a department or didn't split a department. I'm taking it that there were differences of opinion, but there are always differences of opinion over political issues. It was manipulated to become a very highly explosive issue. I suppose the greatest area where it perhaps showed up was in terms of the degree of discipline or approval or disapproval of discipline of student actions. But even that, I seldom became much of an issue within in departmental matters. I'm not quite sure whether I'm distinguishing here, but I think there is a fairly important distinction here. I suppose the other place it showed up that some faculty members were much more operating were cooperating with students in objecting to the war than other department members were, who took a more neutral or opposition stand to student matters.
Yeah.
In my own case, and I've always said, I know that I was not dealing generally with the more radical student groups, but I had two experiences, I suppose. The first experience that I had was right at the time of the Dow thing. I was off the campus and came here to give a seminar, had no idea any problems had existed, and came onto the campus into all the turmoil that had resulted from it. The campus was almost cleared at the point I came on, and I met my seminar, and the students were all pretty excited and reporting many of the cliches and so forth. So since this was an administration seminar, I tried to pose it, knowing not very precisely what had actually occurred, but trying to pose the general problem to them on the grounds that if they were administrators, what would they do and how would they handle it? And I managed to maintain the class from 3:30 to 5:15 or whenever it normally ended by that kind of discussion. I also remember fairly vividly one student saying, very irritated, that they were just a number on the campus, that as long as all they had was a computer number, that's all they amounted to on the campus. And I suggested that you might consider that a legitimate complaint if you never use computers for anything else, but unless they were willing to give up the use of computers for research and for all the things that I knew perfectly well they were using computers for, that I didn't think they had much basis for making a complaint of that kind, that the university's use of computer numbers and registration, recording grades and all the rest of it was pure convenience and a development that had come out of that type of handling of large numbers. And the students obviously weren't going to give up their computers, so we sort of had a draw on that issue. The other time that I was more or less directly involved was right after the Cambodia invasion, and again, for reasons I can't explain except coincidence, I had been in Colorado for a North Central accreditation visit and got back here Thursday night, and I think most of the uproar had been on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. In any event, I got a notice from my seminar that they were much too upset to meet and to complete the work that they were supposed to complete. But they agreed to talk to me the next day, and so the next day I went in and told them that they could only get a grade, as far as I was concerned, if they came to my house and carried on the seminar as we had planned to do. And I remember talking for maybe 10-15 minutes, making the point that I wasn't discussing politics, I was merely trying to carry on the responsibility as a faculty member. And one of the young men finally said, "But Miss Penniman, we're upset." I laughed and I said, "I'm upset too." And they then agreed to come to my house at 6 o'clock. Well, what we did as a final thing in that seminar, and I still use the technique, was to have them present a summary of their seminar papers, much as you would do at a scholarly meeting, and then had critics and commentators and all the rest. So they were supposed to come to my house in the middle of the afternoon on Friday and then be there Friday night and Saturday morning till we were through. Mm-hmm. And it was a class of about 18 people, I've forgotten. Graduate students, 15, 18 people. And anyway, they finally agreed to come. And they came, and it was a very tense evening, but they did what I expected them to do, and they gave summaries of their papers, and we had critics and so forth. So then they were due back at 8:30 the next morning, as I recall it. Anyway, I went out and got some donuts and made some coffee, and so that when they arrived, there were donuts and coffee. Well, one of the girls arrived with donuts too. She didn't know I was getting them, and of course I didn't know she was, but anyway, she brought it. Well, the morning session was then very, very much more relaxed, very, very natural, in fact. And I had the feeling that I had done exactly right, that by getting off the campus, which we'd intended to do all along, and doing what was their normal kind of responsibility as students, that they'd all begun to kind of calm down and take things in stride. And when we got through, nobody made a move to leave. And they just sat there and chatted about everything under the sun. And finally, somebody finally said, well, I need to leave. And so most of them left, but two asked if they could stay back and talk with me. And I said, sure. And so as soon as the others had gone, why, they said they wanted to apologize. And I said, you don't owe me any apology. You did exactly what I asked you as students to do. That's all there is to it. You don't have to apologize to me for anything. Well, then we sat and chatted, and of course they talked about everything, including the war and the problems on the campus and so on. And this went on for an hour or so, and I didn't think we were getting anywhere on this. It was good for them probably, but I didn't think it was important.
Were they among the people who protested the Cambodians?
Yes, I think they were. How actively, I never inquired, but that they were on that general side, yes, that's the impression I had. But I never inquired how actively they were involved. So I finally said, let's go get a hamburger. And the next week, every single student in that seminar came into my office on one pretext or another. They never discussed what had happened. They never did anything, but they just found they had some reason that they could think up to come in and talk with me. So I was very convinced that I'd done what was the appropriate thing to do. And I think if some other faculty members had followed that kind of a routine and recognized this as a teaching responsibility, I think we might have had fewer problems on the campus. But everybody had their own approach. Mm.
The tension the first night was between them and you, or among them, or some.
Oh, I think it was just the natural tension of a situation in which they were still very high strung over what had occurred on the campus, the various kinds of things that occurred. They had somehow convinced themselves they didn't have to do this and would still get through, and I had pushed them on this and insisted that the only way they could get their credits. And I think it was all those things. I didn't have the feeling it was particularly aimed at me, but just this almost the normal situation given all the past, and that by the next morning they had begun to get back into the norm of activity as a student, and therefore they were just about as natural as they could have been in terms of their actions the following morning. I just couldn't have asked for anything.